What's up, guys? This is Mike Casu, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I interview Tom Bilyeu. Tom is the founder of Quest Nutrition and the CEO of a new company called Impact Theory. In this show, we go through the mindset, tactics, etc., that have led to Tom being able to build Quest Nutrition up to a valuation of $1 billion in only 5-6 years. So whether you're an athlete, a coach, a business owner, an entrepreneur, there are just some fucking gems in this. So before we get started, if you haven't done so and you're a regular listener of this show, please take the time to pause this, head to iTunes, leave me a quick review. I'm going to invite any of you that are interested to call into a voicemail that I have set up and leave some questions. So then I'm going to play back your question on the podcast, and I'm either going to answer the question myself or I'm going to get one of my guests to help me answer those questions. If you're interested, the number is 801-449-0503. That's 801-449-0503. Enjoy the show.
Hi, Mike. My name is Gwen Dutrazak. I go to Golly's Performance Center in Guelph, Ontario, Canada. My question is, are there any training principles or nutrition principles or things relevant to that for master's athletes? I am 40 and a half years old, and I train 4 or 5 times a week for CrossFit. And so I'm curious if your guest has any or if you have any ideas about that. Thank you.
Gwen, what's up? Thank you for calling in. I have my director of strength and conditioning, Nick Fowler, on the line. He's gonna help me answer this question because he has a ton of experience working with masters athletes at all levels. So Nick, thanks for making some time to do this, man.
Yeah, I love it. Gwen, great questions. I think as masters athletes, we're constantly trying to find what works for us, and there's less information about us as athletes as we get older. So let me go ahead and just give you three key things you can focus on around training and nutrition specific to masters. There's a lot that we can go into here, but let me just talk about training. And the first thing I would think about is preserving your joints. And the way I typically go about this is reducing running. And so if you have a lot of running in your program, think about subbing it out with ski erg, rowing, air assault is a great thing. This will also help preserve some of the CNS and concurrent signaling. And what I mean by concurrent signaling is that running is a big stress on our bodies, and it can impact our ability to get strong in other areas. Number two, increasing intensity and reducing volume in general as a general principle is always a good thing as we're getting older. So if you have a choice on whether to exclude something, by all means, you can go ahead and do that. Just focus on bringing more intensity to the table. Typically, as masters athletes, we can get a lot more out of it. And then finally, don't compare apples with oranges. I think as we get older, we have less peers to compare how we're doing. And so comparing ourselves to the 20-year-olds in the sport or just in our gym and around us is a really, really kind of big pitfall that I just think that, yeah, just really doesn't help us out, if that makes sense. So I hope those three training principles can kind of help guide you a little bit.
I want to throw out one more and let me know what you think. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that the potential for muscular development is a little bit less the older you get, especially as you get over 35, 40 years old because of hormone levels. So I tend to think that you have more potential for neurological adaptations, and so you should spend a little more time practicing movements, right? Like light barbell work, your technical movements like like butterfly, chest to bar pull-ups, muscle-ups, kind of low intensity, low volume skill work, I think has a very high yield for masters athletes. What are your thoughts on that?
I would 100% agree. I think that's a great takeaway. Yeah, for sure.
So spend a little extra time doing your bar work, doing your very low intensity skill work, and that's going to have a bigger impact than, say, you know, packing on four sets of 10 back squats or something like that.
Yeah, 100%. And I think a great way, Mike, a great way to actually include some of that is just with an extended warm up, which is kind of, you get the, you know, a lot more bang for your buck, where you could get a bigger warm up in and kind of hit the high skill movements you're talking about. So
How about nutrition?
Yeah, nutrition. Nutrition, huge, huge rabbit hole we could go down to. I want to keep it really kind of simple with three things that you can focus on. One, your post-workout nutrition becomes more and more important for a whole bunch of different reasons, but making sure that you get in high glycemic carbohydrates right after you train, number one priority. Think less and be less concerned about your body weight. I think focusing on body composition as we age, we can get away with a lot less. And what I mean by that is that if we're restricting calorie intake, if we're, you know, eating to lean out or for body composition, we will have a bigger impact negatively on our performance than, let's say, a 20-year-old, right? We just can't get away with that as much anymore. So, you know, eat to perform, don't eat to look good, if that makes sense. And number three, make sure you're eating and fully, you know, hitting all your macros on rest days. So make sure your caloric intake is up and your carbohydrate intake is up even on your rest days. You know, your carbohydrate intake on your rest days is going to be your biggest friend when it comes to recovering some of the CNS stress that you've incurred just in your training days. So don't think that rest days, oh, I'm resting, I got to eat less. Don't go down that rabbit hole, right? Keep it, you know, keep it pretty high. What do you think, Mike? You have anything to add to that?
No, I love that. And I think it's very common for people to, on rest days, they feel like they're not earning as many calories, especially carbohydrates. And they don't keep in mind that during that day, during that rest day, they're still going through, they're still using their muscle glycogen, right? And so they get to their next day, their training session, and they're depleted because they didn't eat any carbohydrates in their rest day. So I think that's great advice.
Yeah, yeah. And really the last thing, I'd probably refer, Gwen, you can go check out episode one of the Knowledge Bomb. And if you just go into Google and you type in Brute Strength Masters Knowledge Bomb, the first thing that'll come up is episode one, where I talk about just the considerations for training masters athletes. So you can go look at that. It's a 10-minute video. It's pretty cool. Mary Beth, who won the 55-year-old at the CrossFit Games, is in there. We're talking about you know, her experiences and yeah. So go check that out.
Hell yeah! Thank you, Nick. Hope this helps, Gwen.
Yeah. Take care, Gwen.
All right. What's up, guys? I'm here with Tom Bilyeu. Did I say that correctly?
You said it perfectly.
Tom is the owner of Quest Nutrition. If you haven't already had one of those bars in your mouth, you're missing out. They're the tastiest thing on the market. And Tom is an absolutely incredible entrepreneur, CEO, leader, and he's gracing us with his presence. I know you're super busy, man, and I'm so appreciative of you doing this.
It's an honor to be on, man. And, you know, being busy is really about time management, and I try to do important things first. So this is important, man. I'm excited to be here.
I want to kind of start right there. You talk a lot about, you know, through researching past podcasts you've been on and different shows and interviews you've even given, you talk a lot about integrity and not necessarily using that word per se, but you're just a man of your word and you're very giving of your time. What role does integrity have in your life and your success in business and elsewhere?
Here's how I think of it. Everybody should live by a code. Everybody should, and Pete Carroll, the football coach, calls it a life philosophy. And you've got to know what that compass is by which you steer. So for me, I have a code that is the filter by which I run through all of my decisions. And that you know, just makes it easy. It is who I am. So in times of trouble and stress, that's really when your code is going to step in and make it clear. And being a person that does what they say that they're going to do is certainly a part of my code. Delivering value to the world is a part of my code. Helping other people, and certainly helping other people in a way that I was once helped. All of those things are a part of my code and a part of how I need to behave in order to be the person that I want to be. So I'm always a little shocked that people don't really think about that, and that their behavior can swing so wildly and be so situationally dependent. I always find that a little bit distressing. But I'm not doing it because I think that it makes me a super cool person. I'm doing it because it's how you develop consistency and trust and act in a way that's going to make you feel good about yourself.
Right.
So for me, it's that simple.
So I can absolutely relate to what you're saying, but it's not necessarily something. It's definitely not something I've written down, and at times it's not even conscious. It sounds like something that you're very conscious of. So I'm wondering, do you have any tips for people that want to, I don't know, define their code and like clarify what that is for them?
Yeah, it's interesting. And people have so rarely asked me about that. And I'm always curious as to why people don't. It's a great question. And here's the truth. My code is largely intuitive. There are a few things that would be pretty easy to map out. And every time I get this question, I think, you know, it would actually be utterly fascinating to sit down and write out all of the things that make my code up. But here are some key things that I know are necessary for me to feel about myself the way that I want to feel. So, for instance, I would die for my wife. Now, that's something that I've rehearsed 1,000 times. Excuse me. Obviously, I would rather win for my wife. And so let's take right. an intruder coming into the house or whatever. I like to think that I disarm them and, you know, subdue and or quite frankly, kill, because if they're, you know, trying to come into my house and attack my wife, that is not off the table. But if I found myself somehow, some way in just an absolutely impossible position, that I wouldn't hesitate to die for her. Now, that plays itself out in very fascinating ways. And one of the most interesting for me, because it was proof positive that I've really burned it into my nervous system, is in the middle of the night a few times now in our lives, for whatever reason, the alarm has gone off. And, you know, it's that nighttime alarm where it's just instant, woo, 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 like all hell has broken loose. What's going on? Somebody's in the house. Mm-hmm. And I'm out of bed before I even fully wake up, right? Because I've just rehearsed in my head, like, you've got to charge towards whatever that problem is. And to be me, to be who I want to be, that's just a necessary part. I can't be weak. And because in my life, I have had to become hard, I've had to become tough. I didn't grow up tough. Like, there's just some people that seem like, from word one, man, like, that guy's just tough. I'm not that guy. From word one, I was, you know, shy and a bookworm and afraid. And so for me, having to overcome all of that has been one of the driving forces in my life. So there's a lot of things that I do, including going to the gym every morning and not skipping the gym unless there's something that's of higher priority that beats it out. Mm-hmm. You know, those are all parts of that code. I want to be unstoppable. But if you're going to be unstoppable, you have to back it up through action. So it's things like that, you know, you could and I should take the time to really write down. Another one, I don't lie to my wife. So, but that doesn't mean I don't lie to other people. I do. But to my wife, I don't lie. And that was, you know, a very conscious decision. And because to me, I wanted to be married once and be married forever, mm-hmm. It didn't seem sustainable if I was always keeping her out of parts of my life. So, God, there have been times where I so wanted to lie. It would have made my life so much easier. But, you know, you just don't. And I don't because it makes me feel close to her. Right? In knowing, like, wow, this one person is in just every aspect of my life. And that feels so good to be known and accepted. So that's an absolutely awesome feeling. And I think that it's, you know, I don't lie to her because I also want her to know that she can trust me. But, you know, just knowing that lying puts a distance between you and the other person. And I didn't want that distance between my wife. And I could go on and on and all day, but it's like, those are the kinds of big and small things that build up the code that I live by.
Right. I love what you said there, to be known and be accepted for that. Sounds like some Brené Brown type wording right there. I absolutely love it. You talk a lot about a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. And in fact, you have the book Mindset by Carol Dweck on the top of your reading list. And that's something, that's a book that I recommend to tons of people. And it's come up, multiple times on this show. For those of you who don't remember, a fixed mindset is someone that is crushed by failure. They see others' success as threatening, and they believe that their capabilities, whether it be intellectual, emotional, in their career, etc., are fixed, and they kind of have what they're handed to them at birth. It's genetic. And then a growth-minded person is inspired by others' success, and they see failure as a stepping stone to progress. And they know that if they continue to work on something, that they can, hone any skill and really do and build whatever they want to build. So you talk about this all the time. How do you currently keep yourself in check to make sure that you are not, like, you don't have a fixed mindset about a certain area of your life? How did you learn that? And then how do you continue to keep yourself in check?
So unfortunately, I didn't have Carol's book to shave years of stupid mistakes off my life. It came to me in a flash of anguish, and it went something like this. My business partner and I, we were arguing about something, and I was just getting really, really frustrated about losing this argument. And so I began to think, all right, I've got to get really good at convincing these guys because I want to be right. I built my self-esteem around being right. And with these two guys, I'm just wrong a lot. And it's really, really frustrating. And it was frustrating because it made me feel less about myself because, well, I prided myself on being right. And one day I finally, and the stated goal of my life at that time, it's not true anymore, but at that time, the stated goal of my life was to get rich. And I am arguing, and I win. And the worst part was I just won an argument that I knew I was wrong in. So, and in that moment, I realized, wait a second, if I really want to get rich and their idea is right and it will make the business better and more profitable and would ultimately put more money in my pocket, and I've just convinced them of something that will do the exact opposite, then I don't actually want to be rich. So what is it that's actually driving my behavior? And I was like, oh my God, it is the desire to feel like a stud. Like, that's what's driving my behavior. Right. So that clearly is the overarching goal. And I just thought, but I don't want to feel badly about myself and be rich. Like, if you said, hey, you can be rich, but you're going to feel like shit, would you want to do it? The answer is no, I wouldn't. So I thought, okay, we've got a fundamental problem here. And what could I do differently? I was realizing that my behavior was acting in accordance with a desire that I didn't realize was my primary driver. And that was to feel good about myself instead of actually achieving my goal of getting wealthy. And so I thought, well, I don't want to feel badly about myself. So if somebody had said to me, hey, you can get rich, but you're going to feel like shit, would you want it? My answer would have been no. I want to feel good about myself. I need to feel good about myself. So I thought the real problem is what I'm building my self-esteem around, because I'm building my self-esteem around being smart, being right. And so when I'm not feeling smart and I'm wrong, then I feel badly about myself and I start doing stupid behaviors. So what if instead I built my self-esteem around identifying the right answer faster than anyone else and then putting the energy behind that idea? Mm-hmm. Then I could feel good about myself. I could admit when I was wrong. I could only fight for ideas that made sense. And that would be really an empowering way to build my self-esteem, because the more I fed into my self-esteem, meaning the faster I admitted I was wrong, the faster I identified the right answer, the more like aggressively I put energy into the right answer, no matter who it came from, the better the business is going to be and the better I'm going to feel about myself. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of accidentally put me on the path of a growth mindset, just by realizing when I had a goal, I needed to act in accordance with that goal. And in this case, acting in accordance with the goal of wanting to feel good about myself and accomplish this thing, which was to build a big business to get wealthy, I could actually line those two things up. And in lining those two things up, everything changed about my life. I stopped trying to be smart. I embraced mistakes. I embraced being wrong. I saw it as learning opportunity. And from that moment, everything in my life changed.
Wow. And how many employees do you guys have now?
At the height. So I'm actually now in a founder role. So I'm not there on a day-to-day basis mm-hmm. anymore. But at our height, when I was there, we had, I think, about 1,300, 1,400. And then at our height, we had about 1,400 full-time, but we also had almost 1,000 part-time ambassadors.
Wow.
So it was a lot.
And how do you instill this kind of mindset in so many people? I know that's a huge part of, your role as a leader. I know you put a lot of emphasis on that. How do you do that with such a large group of people?
I actually think I was really bad at that. And that was always one of the super big frustrations for me was how do you scale the mindset? And it was really easy when we were small and people could see me work. Mm-hmm. And that there's a great thing about parenting, you know, parents are convinced their kids don't listen to them. The good or bad news is though, they're always watching.
Right.
And so when people could see me, when I was wearing a hairnet and a lab coat every day and actually making protein bars, mm-hmm. man, the people on the line, they would have killed for me because they saw I'm always willing to take the hardest job. I will work my ass off. I will never complain. And I'll show up responsible for bringing the energy, the enthusiasm, and the solutions. So when they could see that, they could feel it, man, those guys were ride or die for me. Mm-hmm. And it was that was amazing. And I was very good at that. As we started to scale and people didn't know who I was, they didn't have direct interaction with me, or they did know who I was, but I was some sort of mythical figure and not like a person that they knew and had, you know, sweated and toiled with, then it was tough, man. And that is not a nut that I would say that I've cracked. And it's something that I'm very interested in figuring out. And, you know, as we've launched this new company, that's one of the things that's on my mind is as we scale this up, because for me, it's not interesting unless it can become a $1 billion company.
Right.
So as we scale this up, like, what are those systems? How do you do it? And really this time from the ground up, because I've done it once before, it's looking at what are those things that you do now at the beginning that really lay the foundation, because it doesn't scale just to see me work hard. There's got to be things baked into the culture that really educate, reinforce, and reward those behaviors that you want to see in other people, the mindset, the drive, the, you know, the transparency, quite frankly, of making sure that they understand what you're trying to accomplish, what their role is in that, and then how they can grow within the organization. And then just baking into the company your values and things like that get repeated, that become mm-hmm. part of the very fabric of your culture.
Wow, that's powerful, man. So we have a ton of world-class athletes and coaches that listen to this, as well as hundreds of thousands of very serious fitness enthusiasts. How do you go about goal setting? You're an incredibly driven person, and I know you have a million different very big goals. What's your process for defining and clarifying those goals?
So I really do a Venn diagram approach, and I look at what are the things that I'm most interested in. And if that interest is a full-blown passion, even better. And if you guys haven't read the book, So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport, he really talks about how to turn interest into passion, which I think he's right on the money, is something developable. It isn't, you know, like you're born with passion or it's handed down mm-hmm. to you as a lightning rod, but you find something that you're very interested in. Ideally, you find an area of overlapping interests in a place where you can monetize it. And it's that understanding, for me, I believe this is very, very true, that commerce is the only way to control your destiny. And if you can't put yourself in a position where you're making money while you sleep, you're just never going to truly control your own destiny. So I'm looking for that thing that I am deeply passionate about, which for me is always going to be tied to helping other people, and an area that I think I can deliver value. And if it speaks to my strength, even better. But at the end of the day, I ask myself one fundamental question that I really, really encourage people to ask themselves about, which is, what is something that I want to know more about than anyone else in the world? Now, if you think about that, really think about how many people are on this planet. You know, you're talking 7 billion. We're on our way to 9 billion. It's like there's a lot of people. What do you care enough about? What are you fascinated enough about to go so deep and learn so much that you'll know more about it than anyone else? That thing, if you can make money at it, do it. Like that to me is just the no-brainer answer. And there's always stuff that sticks. So if there's something you've had this idea since you were a kid, or you've had this idea for the last 3 years, and no matter how many people tell you it's dumb, you just can't fucking shake it. Then your job is to sit and now really be honest, how do you monetize it? And if you sit through and think through and you see enough opportunity to monetize where you wouldn't have to have 100% of the category to be taking care of yourself, then that's probably a great thing to pursue, especially if you can grind your way there instead of throwing capital at it. And most people allow themselves to be paralyzed because they say, well, you know, I would do it, but I don't have access to capital. You don't need access to capital. You have two things that are incredibly valuable. Money is one, but time is the other. And if you don't have money, throw time at it. And that becomes where you really find out what you care enough about. And here's the honest thing, or here's the important thing. You don't need to be an entrepreneur. There's no moral law that says you need to be an entrepreneur. So if you'd rather chill, if you'd rather eat donuts, if you'd rather just sit back and play video games, own it, man, and do it and build a lifestyle that lets you do that. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm.
So for someone that maybe hasn't found that thing that they're, you know, even significantly interested in, what kind of exercises or even experiences should they seek out to try to hone in on that, to figure out what they're actually interested in that could become a passion?
Yeah, you really just said it. So they need to go out and experience. Marie Forleo has an amazing quote, and I'm going to paraphrase. Unfortunately, I don't remember the exact words, but she's like, you don't overcome indecision through thinking, you overcome it by acting. And what she means is, and the story that she told, she really, really wanted to be a dancer, but she was so terrified to take a dance class. And she didn't know, like, gosh, am I really going to love this? Am I going to embarrass myself? Like, what's this going to look like? And finally, one day, she got up the guts after like years of debating this. She got up the guts and the courage to go take this dance class. And she stood at the back of the dance class and she burst into tears. And the reason she burst into tears was she realized in 5 minutes of dancing that even if she was terrible at it, she loved it so much she wanted to keep doing it.
Wow.
And she realized right then and there, like, why did I debate this for so long? 5 minutes in the class, and I know. And there's going to be a lot of stuff where you go and do it and you absolutely hate it, but at least now you know. And so taking that action, that's the first step. And then the other piece to turning an interest into a passion is very simple: gain mastery. So I don't think anything turns into a passion unless you get good at it.
Ah, very interesting. Very, very interesting. And I love I love number one, because the barrier to entry of that kind of thing is just so low, right? To take one dance class is so low. So if people can really wrap their head around just taking that first step, you know, if they read something like Growth Mindset or something like that, and they're in that right frame of mind, and if they can get themselves to just take that first step, and it may take 10 different first steps before you find that thing you're significantly interested in, but it happens. It always happens. I love that.
100%.
So something else you talk a lot about is you use the phrase, the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. What does that mean? And what is that? How can people apply that?
Humans are a narrative animal. For whatever reason, we constantly are viewing the world through the lens of story. And it's the reason that filmmaking is such the big business that it is. It's the reason that video games are such the big business that they are, is they're really about narrative. And narrative is how we understand our world. We use metaphors, we use allegories, all of that stuff. We use that to understand things, to have some very simple way to understand these incredibly complicated topics. And because we're such a narrative species, we have, for better or worse, developed this voice inside of our heads that is constantly telling us a story about ourselves. We're not good enough. Oh, we're good at this. We're amazing at that. We're terrible at this. We're going to embarrass ourselves. Don't do that. Oh my God, you're going to ruin everything. Don't leave your job. You'll never find another one, right? I mean, that's the voice in your head that's telling you a story. Now, most people don't realize that that's a story. And stories are, by their very essence, malleable. They can be changed. They can be bent and twisted. They rely on perspective. And once you realize that you can change that perspective, that you can begin to tell a different story about the same set of facts, and that's the important part. I'm not saying lie to yourself, though sometimes that can be useful, but you don't even need to do that. Assume that you're never going to lie to yourself. Once you realize you can take the same set of facts and tell two very different stories, that's when everything will change for you. So let's take CrossFit. Let's say that you're this young stud muffin CrossFit guy, and you are training, and oh my God, you're having all this success, and oh man, you're thinking, I am naturally talented at this from my first Fran. I am just killing it. I'm setting records. Nobody can touch me. I go to the regionals. I dominate at regionals. I go to nationals, and I win. And you begin to tell yourself the story of being naturally talented. You just have a gift, man, and you feel bad for other people that don't have it because it's easy for you, and you're looking over at them, and you're thinking, wow, man, like, I can't believe that they're not willing to wake up at 5 a.m. and do this. This is so much fun. I can't believe, like, I saw them. They had another rep in them, and they didn't do it. Like, wow, like, that's crazy. If they were naturally talented like me, they would see that this is a lot of fun. They would see, like, how great you can be if you just believe in yourself. That's story one. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens to that person? That person, and they get in an accident, and they hurt their back. And now, all of a sudden, lifting is hard as hell for them. And the ease with which they were doing things is all gone. Now they don't want to do it anymore. They don't want to push because it's not who they are. They're the naturally talented guy. So now, with their back injuries, they start asking, why did this happen to me? Why ruin such a beautiful gift of natural talent? Now let's rewind. Take the same person. But the story they tell themselves is, I learn fast. I listen, I pay attention. I get up, I work hard, I outwork people. Now, it's the same person. They put in all the same work, but instead of focusing on the fact that it was easy, they focus on the fact that, hey, while everybody else is sleeping, I'm here at 5 a.m. While everybody else puts down that weight when they get tired, I don't, because fatigue to me is nothing. I have a goal. I'm to become the best, and I'm willing to learn, and I'm willing to suffer, and I'm willing to go the extra mile. And when my love for this gives out, that's okay. My desire to accomplish something, my willingness to learn and get better, that will kick in and drive me forward. Now, that person gets hurt, and they say, all right, this is a setback. It sucks. Maybe I'm even a little bit pissed about it. But I'm the guy who learns. So I'm going to learn about fighting through an injury. I'm going to learn about the body. I'm going to learn how to rebuild myself. And I'm willing to suffer. I'm willing to show up and put in the work. And I will outwork everybody. And despite having a bad back, I'm going to push so fucking hard that I'm going to win by more than I ever won in the past.
God, it's the same damn person. We're gonna fucking take a little snippet of that and put that on our sales page, man. I love that. That was excellent. How can people become more aware of these stories? I think a lot of people are so they lack self awareness to such a degree that they can't even hear that. They can't even see that those beliefs, those thoughts in their head. How do you recommend people work on self awareness?
It's the same thing that I recommend for any skill anybody's trying to acquire. Read a book. So I am so insanely grateful to the untold number of people that have been gracious enough to write down their knowledge in books over the centuries. I mean, honestly, do people make money for doing it? Yes, of course they do. But there are easier ways to make money. And the fact that people are willing to share their hard-won knowledge, man, it has shaped my life. So I'm just crazy, crazy grateful. And anything anyone ever has ever wanted to learn, I promise you, somebody somewhere has done it and written it down in a book.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. To run a company of your size, you've got to you have to have a certain level of discipline. And I would assume you're incredibly disciplined today. So my question is, have you always been that way? And if not, how have you cultivated it?
I am by nature one of the laziest people you're ever going to meet. My mother used to fight endlessly with me because I was so profoundly lazy. I put more energy into fighting against doing something than it would have taken just to do it. So yeah, I definitely am not disciplined by nature, but I am ambitious as all get out. So I've always had a vision for my life that was big, and I have fed that vision and treated it like an ember and blown on it and put kindling on it and really turned it into a raging fire by obsessively thinking about it. And out of that, I began asking myself a very simple question. Is this fire a pacifier to keep me from noticing that I'm not actually doing anything? Or am I actually going to use this fire to execute? And at that point, I began asking myself the only questions that matter, which are, what do I need to do to actually accomplish this, to not play at it, to actually do it? And one of the first things I realized was the people who accomplish are the people that can hold true to something over a very long period of time. And to do that, you've got to develop discipline. Now, the thing that I use to create discipline in my life, since I don't have it by nature, is I use bright lines. Now, like anybody else, I would love to emotionally eat. And oh, dear God, right now, the sound of a donut sounds so good. But I'm not going to eat a donut because I have a bright line that says I eat these meals throughout the day, and these meals consist of these things, eaten at these times. Like one of my meals is eaten at 11:30. I can't tell you how many times I've sat there and thought, it's 11:27. I can eat this meal now. What's 3 minutes? Come on, it's a joke. And, you know, I'm actually getting a little distracted right now. And if I ate, I'd feel better. It's only 3 minutes. And I never eat that meal 3 minutes early, no matter how inconvenient, no matter if I'm getting a headache, no matter if I'm feeling fatigued. I don't eat that meal until 11:30 because that is the bright line. And once you have those bright lines in your life, suddenly everything gets a lot easier. And Jocko Willink talks about this. There is freedom in discipline. When you make yourself a promise and you know, I will keep this promise, come hell or high water, I'm going to keep this promise. Then all of a sudden, showing up to the gym, eating right, doing the things you need to do to help your business be successful, working long hours, they all become very, very easy because they are subject to the law of bright lines.
So how can people, you know, someone that is very, very ambitious, they want to accomplish great things, and they just heard you say that, would you suggest that they create 10 plus bright lines today? Or is there another strategy to build that kind of slowly and progressively? How would they go about that?
If they try to set 10 bright lines today, they're setting themselves up for failure. So what people have to understand is you have to earn credibility with yourself. So big bright lines work for me because I've spent, you know, more than a decade earning that credibility with myself of knowing, first of all, I'm not going to set a bright line stupidly, so I'm really going to think about it. Mm-hmm. And then second, I'm setting a bright line that's in service of a goal that I very much care about so that I'll have that energy pushing me on the back. And those two really, really are critical. What I suggest people do is get some small wins. I use the gym to get to my mind. I do not use the gym. I mean, look, am I grateful for the physical impact of the gym? Yes. But I'm actually showing up to earn credibility with myself, right, to say, I'm going to show up at the gym today, even though I don't want to. I'm going to lift, even though I don't enjoy it. I'm going to push myself, even though it hurts. Like, I'm going to do all those things. And with every rep that I do, I earn credibility with myself. And so bright lines are the same way. So for me, going to the gym is a bright line. I do it whether I want to or not. The way that I eat is bright lines. But people should pick a simple bright line. And, you know, depending on, it's going to be determined by what their issue is. So if you're having trouble waking up in the morning, I'll just tell you right now, you need to go to bed earlier. So set a bright line, right? So if you go to bed sometime between midnight and 1 a.m., you now go to bed at 12:50, simple as, period, done, bright line. And that, like, you're literally shaving 10 minutes off of your, you know, sort of simple bedtime for you. Right. And once you start sticking to that win, or do what Tim Ferriss does, he makes his bed every day. Simple, bright line. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a bright line. So what does he do when he's in a hotel room? He makes his bed anyway. Right. That's the nature of a bright line. So doing things like that, earning that credibility, putting order and structure to your day, you do 10 things like that that are simple that you know you're not going to back out on, because if you back out, you're going to lose credibility with yourself. And so it's that stuff that you do when nobody's looking. That stuff matters more than you can imagine.
I have learned that in such a big way over the past few years. As an entrepreneur of a 100% digital company, I literally don't have to have any structure at all in any regard. And so, you know, when I first started Brute, I had no discipline whatsoever when it came to business or my life in general. At least that's what it feels like. And I've noticed the more, you know, kind of constraints, and as you're talking about bright lines that I put in my life, and the more things that I can stick to, the faster I've been able to work, the more effective I've been, efficient I've been, and just happier in general, right? Once I have those constraints, I have more direction in which to point my energy. So I think a lot of people can relate to this in some form or another. So that was huge. I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
So let's start talking about business a little bit. This year, Quest Nutrition did over $1 billion. Is that correct?
Now, Quest is valued at over $1 billion. Okay. We're in the very fortunate position of being private, so we don't report our revenues. But yeah, so the valuation.
Gotcha. Revenue. Awesome. And you've got, at one point you had over 1,400 employees, 1,000 other reps. You're leading a ton of people. How would you describe your thought process in leading such a large group, and what have been some of your biggest influences on the way that you lead?
Really, when you're at that level, it's all about trying to help them be successful. So you become less and less in charge of doing any one thing specifically, and more in charge of creating the atmosphere in which other people can execute on things. And it is such a complicated task that every day is a learning game. And every day I tried to open my mind up to looking super nakedly at the things that I was doing wrong, which were legion, and to really figure out, how do I improve today so that more people are able to engage, to really be empowered by this system, this environment that we're creating, so that they can do their best work, so that they can help the company move forward. And, you know, one of the things that I found, and this is something that I'm shocked I am so bad at, because I consider myself a high level communicator, but there's being good at communicating, and then there's being effective at communicating to a massive number of people. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the nuts that I'm still working on cracking. Because as you grow, just getting people to understand what the vision of the company is, as it changes, as it evolves, to help them understand that, to facilitate not only a one-way conversation, but a two-way dialogue, so that people can be giving that feedback back to you, that you've built it into the organization, that people feel that their voice is heard, that they know where the ship is headed. Like, all of that stuff then feeds into morale, and really creating morale, creating an energy, a feeling in the employees, in the team, that the company wants for the employee success as much as the employee wants for the company success. And when you can create that environment, then you get really, really something special, because people are really willing to give themselves to the company to be creative. I mean, you spend more than 50% of your waking hours at your job. Mm-hmm. And if you're not creating an environment where people can love that, like, you're really, really in trouble. And it's really fascinating to see how you may do it for one group, but another group struggles. One person may come in my office and tell me, oh my God, this is like the best. You've touched my life in like 1,000 ways. And then somebody else comes in and they're like, I feel like I'm being tortured. I've got to get out of here. And you're like, what the fuck? It's like the same company, but it's impacting these two people mm-hmm. wildly differently. And so, you know, finding your way through that to really foster an empowering environment where people can gain mastery, where people understand how their actions matter. They know what the purpose is of the company, so that they can understand how their purpose can fit here within the organization. They know what they're contributing to. All of that stuff is so, so critical. But at the end of the day, the simple thing that it comes down to are the people, like the individualized people, not just people sort of en masse. You've really got to be growing to understand how to empower the individual.
Right. So you talk a lot about purpose and vision in general. And I'm curious how you crafted your vision for Quest. Is it similar to the goal setting process you were talking about earlier, or if not, how does that differ?
It really is very similar. With goals, to me, you need one to know what you're trying to accomplish. So we were trying to end metabolic disease. Once you understand that, then it's like, okay, what are the medium and basic goals that I need to be setting in order to get to that grand goal, right? Because you're, you know, even putting out a protein bar, even having a company with massive revenues, like that doesn't actually address that problem. They are key parts in that, but even within each of those, there are, you know, 1,000 smaller goals. So it's really about answering the question, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? So how do we break these down into highly actionable things that we can do right now, and breaking them down by department, but really getting the clarity of what needs to be done, what's going to be the easiest to do, that has the most impact, and then being able to see when you're getting off course and being able to course correct, which is definitely something that you know, I want to continue to get better at, is really being able to look where are we headed now and what do we need to do to steer ourselves in a new direction, to constantly reevaluate, constantly do red team, blue team, meaning, okay, this is what we think we should be doing, but we need to have a red team, some of our smartest, brightest people attack it and find the holes in the strategy so that we can address them now. You know, it's that concept of change before you need to. Mm-hmm.
So when Adi and I met you a while back, you told us that you were in a company before this for, I don't know, eight years, and that it was kind of a miserable experience. Can you talk a little bit about what kept you in that, or rather what kept you from leaving that company?
Yeah. So with anything, you set a goal, if you're tenacious, if you're gritty and disciplined, chances are that you'll stick with it longer than you probably should have. And it was a company that really I wasn't passionate about. I didn't have interest in the product that we were making. And that should have been my first red flag. It was not an area that I wanted to know more about than anyone else in the world. That was my second red flag. Mm-hmm. I wasn't having fun. That's another red flag. So all of those should have made me stop, take stock, and say, you know what, I don't want to continue down this path. But I kept doing it because, one, I thought we were going to be able to get the company to the point where we could sell it and then, you know, do the next thing, which was going to be our passion play. And I think a lot of people use a lot of years of their life to say, well, I'm just going to get rich first and then I'll go do what I really care about, right? Like, how many people? I'm going to get rich here and then I'm going to go do my music or whatever. And I think people have to make the demand of themselves that I'm going to generate my income or generate my wealth doing the thing that I love. And I think that really is just an absolute key. And then quite frankly, I did quit the company. So about around the 6 year mark, I'd really stopped having fun. No longer wanted to keep pushing. I thought, this doesn't make any sense. I'm going to go do something that in the moment I love. And for me, my highest priority in business is camaraderie. And I had lost that with my business partners. I didn't feel connected to them anymore. And so it was like, well, I'm totally fed up chasing money. I don't feel connected to these guys anymore. You know, so there's just nothing left. Mm-hmm. And so I brought them in a room and I said, look, I don't want to end on a bad note, but I'm not having fun anymore. And so I think it's time for me to go. And they said what, you know, now are sort of famous words. They said, we could do this without you, but we don't want to. We'd like you to stay and let's do this together. if we can't hit our revenue goals in X period of time, then we'll sell the company and we'll move on to the thing that we're all going to care about and be passionate about. And, and so that's exactly what we did. We ended up selling that company, and then that passion play ended up being Quest. It ended up being the best decision that, you know, we'd ever made to finally make the demand that we make money doing something that we love, believe in, can stand behind. So it ended up being a pretty big shift. So it was a bit of the Godfather moment. Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
No shit.
But it was amazing, and I'm so glad they did. And obviously Quest ended up changing all of our lives.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't know it was the same. You started this company with the same guys from the last one. That's very interesting. What do you think, if you could, like specific examples of what was keeping you from having that camaraderie in that other company?
I think that you start burning out and frustration starts creeping in, and you just, you know, at least the three of us really just started digging in deeper and deeper into the world of, okay, this is my role and I need to do this. And so you're just spending all of your time there and being frustrated, and there's just, you're not having fun. So there just kind of is that funk that falls over the office. And then you begin to associate that with the people that you're around. And so I remember for years after selling that company, I would get this foreboding feeling just driving through the neighborhood that our office used to be in. So it's like you really do just like a cloud settles over things. And so it wasn't until, and then at that point, obviously we said, hey, we need to revitalize the friendship and everything. And so ended up putting a lot more time and attention on that. And that was very, very helpful. But yeah, I mean, you just get caught up in the this sucks mentality and not having fun. And yeah, that was it.
It just brings you down altogether. That makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I heard you say on Lewis Howes' podcast that every problem you encounter in your business is a result of you not acknowledging some aspect of the human condition. Your employees aren't sinister. They're not trying to bring you down, et cetera. And it's more so that they just want to feel significant in your business. And that was very powerful hearing that. And I'm wondering what specific ways you can make your employees feel significant and in general, like how do you do it?
So a big one is connecting them to the mission of what your company is trying to accomplish. So I firmly believe every company should have a very strong mission. And when people know how they're contributing to that mission, when they understand it, they understand how everything is driving towards that, and they understand the role that they're playing, and they understand that their contributions actually feed into that and that they're appreciated, that's when people are able to really start to feel that, and when they don't feel micromanaged. So they have a degree of autonomy. They're able to learn. They're able to learn from their mistakes. They're able to grow and get better. All of those things really feed into that.
Wow. I love it. I got a couple more questions for you before we wrap it up.
Sure.
You're big on defining terms, and I've even heard you talk about it in terms of your relationship, but how do you define success?
Success for me is one of those things that is entirely personal, and I think anybody's answer that doesn't involve acknowledgement of brain chemistry is fooling themselves, and they will sadly fall into the camp that I spent a lot of my life in, which is having all the things you thought you wanted only to still be unhappy. And so success to me at the end of the day is so inextricably tied to fulfillment and happiness, which are two sides of the same coin for me. So happiness is very transient. It's momentary. Fulfillment is happiness, but on a longer timeline. Happiness is usually born of just an entirely pleasurable activity. And then fulfillment is often born of suffering. And it's the willingness to do that hard thing that makes you feel good and fulfilled. So imagine Mother Teresa, right? Her job, oh dear God, I can only imagine that would be brutally difficult. But she did it because of that tremendous sense of well-being that it provided her to do something so meaningful for other people. You know, and the same with working out, right? If it were easy, people wouldn't take pride in it. If you could snap your fingers and be yoked and be super strong, like who would really care? It's the very fact that it's super hard and that you have to go in and sweat and be gasping for breath and, you know, drag yourself when you're exhausted to still hit the gym and to be consistent and to be disciplined with your diet. It is the fact that you have to suffer for it that gives you that sense of being something. And that being something is something people can't take away from you. That's fulfillment. A bowl of ice cream, on the other hand, that shit is happiness because it'll put you in a good mood. Like, that's just the way that sugar works, right? It tastes good, lights up the dopamine centers, and it's amazing. And I think a life that was pure fulfillment and didn't have happiness would also be missing something. So I think that you need both of those things. And finding significance to me is one of the ways to fulfillment, doing something that you believe matters, that you believe you're really contributing to. That, all of that to me is success.
I love that. So your measure of success is how many things that you're doing in your life or that, how much time you're spending doing things that are fulfilling.
Yeah. Let me just take your, you know, your brain chemistry. Like, let me check your blood levels and I'll tell you whether that person is actually doing things that are in my definition successful. Now, at the same time, I have business definitions of success as well that have to do with monetary accomplishment, that have to do with freedom, being able to control my destiny, you know, being able to invest in certain things or charities or be able to do things for my family. You know, all of that stuff is also a definition of, you know, a much more specific class of success.
So I want to finish up on this. I've heard you say in multiple places that your wife is the most important thing in the world to you. And it's not, you're both extremely busy. Even though you're working together, I know that you're extremely busy and it can be hard to, it can be hard to spend enough time with people, with your partner, your loved one. So I'm wondering how you guys make it all work when you're running these huge companies, you're working together. How do you work together to create, you know, kind of a synergistic effect? And also, how do you work together and separate work even to make sure that your relationship is getting the attention it needs?
We are very good at making sure that we set aside time to just be together, to do something that is very simple, very pleasurable. It could be just eat a meal, enjoy a sunset, you know, cuddle, literally just be together. Mm-hmm. And then we've also figured out how to deal with business in a pure business way and then deal with business in, a more relationship way. So imagine, back at Quest, my wife was literally one of my employees. And so there were days where she's coming home saying, my boss is an asshole, right? And I am said boss. So it's like, right. you have to find those ways to talk and let her be able to speak like a wife to a husband. And I have to not try to solve that problem. I have to not be defensive because obviously it's me that she's frustrated with. And now that we're working as equal partners, it's certainly easier in some ways. It can be more difficult in others where, okay, this is a true 50-50 partnership. And when we set up the company, literally the lawyer was like, you know, you're creating like a nightmare divorce scenario. And I said, that is perfect. I want you to create a situation that is the worst thing you can think of from a divorce standpoint. Because to me, if you're not willing to like put that situation out there, the other person knows you don't trust them. And the other person knows we're not really equal partners. And, mm-hmm. you know, so for me, it's like either my relationship with my wife really is my highest priority or it's not. But there are, one of the ways that we define things to make it easier is to have roles. So I am very much the alpha. She is very much the beta. Now, we have an understanding, though, of alpha and beta that's probably very different than the rest of the world. We take our definition from wolves. And if you look at a beta wolf is a badass. A beta wolf is not there to play around. They are there to help execute and enforce the decisions of the alpha. But in no way, shape, or form is the beta submissive. And when I saw that sometimes betas are tougher than the alpha, And for whatever reason, the beta has simply decided the alpha is the right one to make the decisions. That's when I realized, whoa, these are equals with different roles. And that's exactly what my wife and I are. We are equals with different roles. And being able to play with people like that, no matter where they are in your organization, that, hey, maybe I'm the CEO, but we're equals with different roles. So you're entrusting me to lead. You're entrusting me to make certain decisions. You're entrusting me to have the vision. But just because you're on your first day as a junior marketer doesn't mean I'm more important than you. It just means that we have different roles. And I mean important, like as a person, as a human, I don't have more value than you. So now if we can approach each other like that and you can actually treat me like you're my equal, then now you've got a shot, because you're not wasting time being blinded by the position, right? Which happens a lot. Mm-hmm. So, and if I can not be sitting on a high horse somewhere, not feel that, hey, I'm the CEO, I shouldn't have to clean this up, and recognize that I'm not better than anybody. I'm not more valuable than anybody. And this is important. I'm not more valuable, even if I can generate more value for the company. Right. And once you understand that's the same word with two dramatically different definitions, then we're fine. I may be able to generate more revenue, but that doesn't make me a more valuable human being. And when people feel that, like, whoa, like he's able to generate more value for the company, he's got a higher position than I am. He's, you know, in this case, he's funding everything, whatever the case may be, but he never acts like he's a more valuable human being. And he does not ask me to act like I'm a less valuable human being. Now, that's when you get the best out of people. That's when you get great ideas, because people will step to you like you're your equal. And the only reason you should ever have a problem with that is because you're insecure. If you're secure, you want people to step with their A game. You want people to bring it and show their great ideas. Now, just as I would be respectful to a stranger, regardless of position, I'm going to be respectful to everybody in my company. And I would expect the same. But I don't ever want someone to defer to me because of my title. That's stupid.
Right.
I want someone to follow the right idea. And if they think it's the wrong idea, I want them to speak up.
I love that. We started on it. We ended on it. It all comes back to that about, you know, getting on the same vision, the same mission, in line with the same mission, and just putting on a search party for the right answer rather than just trying to be right. So I love how you tied that into so many different things. This was great, man. You've got, let's see, you had Impact Theory just launched. Can you tell us a little bit about that company?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two major movements in my life, the body and the mind. And to me, they are inextricably connected. And Quest is just an amazing company, and I'm so proud of it and so excited to see where they continue to take it now that I'm in a founder role. And now this is giving me the time that I need to build my second love, which is something centered entirely around the mind and well-being, and that's Impact Theory. And we have a very big mission. And I think that right now we have two pandemics. You've got the pandemic of the body, obesity, all the diseases related to diet. And then you've got the pandemic of the mind, and you've got just unheard of levels of depression and anxiety. And I just heard a stat yesterday that between, I think it's like 20 and 44, the number one cause of death with males is suicide. Like, that's crazy. Jesus. So in a world where that is true, where we've never had access to more resources or information, and the number one cause of death is suicide, it's just not tolerable. So I building everything off of the show, which used to be called Inside Quest, we've now spun it out of the company and rebranded it as Impact Theory, is to walk people through the mindset of the most successful people on the planet and show them the adaptations that they would have to make to the way that they think in order to execute at the highest level. And then that's sort of phase one. And then phase two is to build the largest library of empowering intellectual property the world has ever seen. And I include companies in that, as well as things like books, movies, comics, all the things that really speak to me and have shaped who I am as a human being. So it's got a very immediate term, which is the show. And I've started now traveling and speaking, and I'm really plugging into that world. And then building something that I believe could be a billion-dollar business, and on the side of creating this intellectual property and incubating and accelerating companies.
So inspiring, man. It's especially inspiring to me and hopefully to others to think bigger and to follow, you know, my biggest passions and dreams and try to see them through. It's just amazing, man. Where can people find out more about you personally and what you've got going on?
Yeah, you can go to impacttheory.com or you can follow me at Tom Bilyeu. And the last name is spelled B as in Bravo, I-L-Y-E-U.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for your time, bro. Appreciate it.
You got it. Thanks for having me on, man. It was a real pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.